heard a great deal from the archaeologists and the New Testament exegetes and the exegetes of the Old Testament, but the one thing that they haven't really given us yet is any clear portrait of Abraham. So I thought that since we now moved into a much richer period in terms of the history of Christian ideas, that I would bring along some pictures of him so you'd see what he looks like. So I have a few pictures here on the slides. I have a few others that I'd like to show along the way here, but just to give you some impression of what Abraham looked like. This is from the Church of San Vitale in Ravenna, 6th century building. And as you see from this is it's really a narrative sequence, and it pulls out two events in Abraham's life. One is the meeting at Mamre with the three visitors, which was interpreted by many of the fathers as a revelation of God, and in later tradition, probably not yet at this period, obviously that would suggest the Trinity. So it was the Trinity that was revealed to Abraham at Mamre. And the other one here is the sacrifice of Isaac. I'll get them to you a little bit closer. There's the sacrifice of Isaac. I don't think so.
You push the other button.
Oh, yes, it is. Yes, right. It's a pin.
Or is that there is. Right up the very corner. Right. Just reaching down.
Oh, that's cool.
Push the button back again.
Yeah, right. Yeah. We will turn the mic. I didn't realize that the seminary was so well equipped to reproduce things, and so I didn't really send any material ahead, and I have all sorts of pictures here of other representations of Abraham and Isaac in the early church. And if I would have known that Gressler could just kind of churn these things out, if he only had about 2 days, I could have had a really nice presentation of slides, because one of the most curious and interesting things about Abraham is that he is probably the most represented pictorially figure from the Old Testament in early Christianity. In fact, the particular representation of Abraham and Isaac occurs about 200 times during the very early period. So that in itself is something that we'd like to talk about. I think maybe I'll make a few comments before I begin. I think I'll proceed a little differently than had the other men. I came more or less prepared with a kind of paper as such, and it's actually brief. I set myself a... having spoken on other occasions, I just said I'm going to stop at 15 pages, and I did. So I tried to put everything within the compass of 15 pages. And I think what I can do is probably present this material now and then have some time for discussion. Then perhaps the session, which is also allotted to the early church this afternoon, it would be possible to have a more general kind of discussion. Maybe I'll make an initial statement, which could lead us into a discussion of the developing Christian interpretation and what it means for Christians to interpret a figure such as Abraham in their own historical context. But before we get to the question of method or the question of the larger interpretation, let's look at some of the material that we do have. For those of you who are not wholly familiar with the period of Christian history in the first few centuries, what we're really talking about is the history of Christianity from its beginning until approximately the 5th or 6th century. That is the major period of the growth and development of Christianity in its first historical experience, and the development which takes place in the main within the context of the Roman Empire and the Greco-Roman world. In terms of the amount of literature and archaeological remains and inscriptions and all of the other data that historians use, there are literally thousands upon thousands of pages of material to interpret Christianity during this period, and to that must be added all of the Jewish material as well as all of the Greek and Roman material. And on a figure such as Abraham, much to really my surprise, I was quite uninformed on this topic when I first began examining it, we have literally hundreds of pages of material on Abraham, plus all of these representations, these pictorial representations of Abraham, so that it's not possible to take a few texts and to go through them line by line because there are simply too many. Furthermore, the variety of interpretations is so extensive that one has to begin to narrow it down. So we're dealing with a large body of material over many centuries, people living in different kinds of situations, and partly for that reason, the interpretations of Abraham come out to be very, very varied. So that will be, of course, one of the main things that we would like to talk about, namely the variety and diversity. There are few scenes more frequent in early Christian art than Abraham's sacrifice of Isaac. It occurs as early as the second century on wall frescoes in the catacombs. And let me just show you here very briefly. Here is a fresco from a catacomb of Abraham and Isaac.
There's an old paint projector here, which they said it doesn't work.
I don't think it's really necessary. I mean, it's not. I don't want to make a big deal out of it. I just want to give you some. I'll pass the book around. This is simply a photograph of a wall painting in a catacomb of the sacrifice of Abraham and Isaac. And there are others. I'll pass this volume around in a minute. Furthermore, it is carved into literally dozens of early Christian sarcophagi. That are these tombs in which people were buried. That's what this book is all about, and I'll just try to show you one of these to give you an impression of what that looks like. See if I get the right one here. Yes,
here you go. Oh, wait, it comes out of paperback.
You see here, this is sacrificing. Want to go back further? Here is the lamb. Here is Abraham with the knife over upheld here, and here's Isaac kneeling there, and he's ready to offer the sacrifice. And this and others like it occur in, let's say, literally dozens of early Christian sarcophagi. I've put some pages in here.
And around the truck.
Well, you can probably come look at it.
If you handle that book, please use it.
This is a very valuable book, and I was quite impressed, frankly, that this was in the library.
Five volumes are worth about $750.
A fantastic book. So those are marked in here. It'll probably take you a while to discover the particular figure of Abraham and Isaac. You can find them on the pages that are marked here. Furthermore, it's set in mosaics and adorns basilicas in Rome, Ravenna, and its environs and elsewhere, such as the one that is represented here. It is etched on gold cups and rings and painted on bowls and plates from North Africa to Syria to Asia Minor. Now, the sheer frequency of the appearance of this particular scene from Abraham's life is, I think, noteworthy. And this is even more striking, though probably less striking after Krentz's presentation, when one considers the New Testament, because as one reads again the text of the New Testament and not the traditions that lie behind the text, the figure of Isaac being sacrificed is mentioned only in two places. One of Hebrews 11:17, by faith Abraham, when the test came, offered up Isaac. And James 2:20, was it not by his action in offering his son upon the altar that our father Abraham was justified? Surely you can see that faith was at work in his actions, and that by these actions the integrity of his faith was fully proved. The only two instances where it is explicit. The more important discussion of Abraham in the New Testament occurs, as we've seen, in Romans 4, Galatians 3, and which we did not see, John 8, where Abraham is pictured, at least specifically in the Romans and to a different extent in John, as the one who trusts God's promise, and this promise then is interpreted specifically within the Christian context. So the passage, Abraham put his faith in God, and that faith was counted to him as righteousness, which is cited by Romans, by Paul in Romans 4, actually, however, comes from Genesis 15, which is not the Abraham and Isaac story. The Abraham and Isaac story comes in Genesis 22. So the text, his faith was counted to him for righteousness, has to do with the promise of the land and the seed. And it's interesting, I think, that in light of that, that the figure of Isaac becomes so important. Secondly, not only does the sacrifice of Isaac achieve greater prominence in the Christian interpretation during the period we're talking about, Isaac's sacrifice is taken in a quite different sense than it is in the New Testament, or at least as I would think it was taken in the New Testament. As important as was the faith, or the hope of Abraham for early Christian writers, they were more impressed by the Christological dimensions of the sacrifice. The sacrifice of Isaac for most early Christians was regularly taken to be a type of the sacrificial work of Christ on the cross, so that they saw in that sacrifice many of the same things that they then saw in Jesus. As early as the middle of the second century, one bishop by the name of Melito, living in Asia Minor in Sardis, could write, now this is the first time that this occurs, in the place of Isaac the righteous, a ram appeared as victim so that Isaac might be freed of his bonds. By sacrificing the ram, Abraham liberated Isaac. In the same way, the Lord, by becoming a victim, liberated us. By being bound, he freed us. By being sacrificed, he redeemed us. For, and then he quotes Isaiah, as a ram he was bound, says Isaiah of our Lord Jesus, and as a lamb he was shorn, and as a piece of cattle he was led to slaughter, and he was crucified, and he carried the wood on his shoulders when he was led forth to be sacrificed, as Isaac carries the wood up the mountain, as Isaac was sacrificed by his father. But Christ underwent the sufferings, but Isaac did not, for he was only a prefiguration of him who would suffer. What I'm saying is that that particular interpretation, which does not occur in the New Testament, is the first interpretation that we meet in this next period, namely the second century. But even this interpretation is only one among many. From the early second century to the middle of the fifth century, Abraham exercised a powerful attraction on the Christian imagination. Origen, a Greek writing in Alexandria in the middle of the 3rd century, devotes pages and pages of his homilies on Genesis to Abraham. Ambrose, a Latin writer in Milan in the 4th century, devotes two whole books to Abraham. Gregory of Nyssa, a bishop living in Asia Minor in the 4th century, devotes homilies to Abraham. Interestingly, he puts Abraham into a homily on the deity of Christ and the Holy Spirit and finds him useful to establish that particular point. Chrysostom preached on him, another 4th century Greek writer. Cyril of Alexandria, a 5th century writer in Egypt or Alexandria, wrote a book on Genesis in which he devotes a whole section to Abraham. He wrote a homily in which he uses Abraham to criticize Judaism. Augustine gives over to him literally dozens of chapters in The City of God, Book 16, and numerous other writers hold him up as a model and an example to Christians. Now, the interpretations of all these men vary considerably from man to man and within each man, depending on the situation they were addressing. Some writers, for example, following Jewish tradition, presented Abraham as the great representative of monotheism. That is, he comes out representing a certain belief, which Christians and Jews considered important. And they read him in this way because he was the man who first turned decisively away from the worship of idols and from astrology, from the worship of the sun and the moon and the stars to the worship of one God. Let me give you just one little rabbinic passage which is kind of interesting. It is said that Abraham first saw the sun as a god, and then he discovered that at the end of the day the sun disappeared. And then he looked and he saw the moon, and he said, well, the moon must be gone. And the next morning the moon was gone. And he looked at the stars, and he found that the stars changed their shape. And so then he began to realize that all of these ways of worshiping God were idols. But his father was supposed to be an idol worshiper. And he tried to get his father to get rid of the idols. And one day his father was gone. And in the meantime, Abraham simply broke the idols and threw them out. And so his father came home and he says, well, what happened to that particular idol? He says, well, they got in a quarrel and the big one beat up the little one and killed him. And so that's why he's no longer here. And his father says, well, how can that be? They're only idols. And he says, well, how can you worship them then? So, but the Christian interpretation goes beyond this. It says further that he was known to have come from Ur of the Chaldees, and that was in Assyria, and that was known to be a place where astrology had begun and was rampant. So it was very natural to say that he had moved out of astrology and superstition to worship the one God. But the Christian writers then take it one step further and to say that he's not only an example of a man who worships the one God, but he has a very exalted view of God, because he realized that God would not be seen in the things of nature, in the things that one receives by his senses, but that God has to be contemplated by the mind. And so Gregory of Nyssa, this 4th century bishop, says, Abraham's mind soared to things which were much higher, and he finally rested on the God who was above all, the source of all beauty, God himself, who is without beginning, infinite, who is greater and more sublime than any tokens or traces that are left on earth. So you see God by contemplating and turning in on yourself and then turning to God. For this reason, he says, Abraham said to God, I am but dust and ashes, and this faith was counted to him for righteousness. This faith in that kind of a God. Abraham was also thought to be a symbol of hospitality because of his gracious and generous treatment of the three visitors at Mamre. Others saw him as a symbol of God the Father, because just as Abraham willingly gave up his son Isaac, so God loved the world that he gave up his son. He was thought to be the first Christian. This really follows pretty much on the Pauline thing, because he did not rely on the law, as did the later Israelites, but believed prior to the time of his circumcision. And so that would then be an indication that Abraham believed, and then Judaism came in, and this belief was changed. So in this view, then, Abraham is contrasted with Moses, who usually in the Fathers comes out to be a negative figure, Moses. Moses is the preeminent founder of Judaism, the lawgiver, and Abraham then becomes the source of that true original religion, which now the Christians believe they represent. So it becomes, in fact, a historical way of interpreting the relation of Christianity to Judaism. You have to explain somehow why this other religion existed before Christianity comes, and so you say, well, there really was one prior to that, and we now republish the original religion that God gave in the form that it has now been revealed to us. And there was this interim period that was necessary. So it becomes a historical view. Now, in the midst of the heterogeneity and the diversity of the early Christian view of Abraham, one is prompted to ask, will the real Abraham stand up? That is, whose view is the true one? Which is closer to the Abraham of Genesis? Or, since the material was presented even in Genesis as an interpretation, who is closer to the historical Abraham? Or who is closer to the Abraham of Paul or John or other New Testament writers? That is there a true Abraham and a true interpretation of Abraham, or can Abraham become whatever strikes one's fancy? The variety of interpretation arises in part, I think, simply because Abraham is such an interesting figure. It's also because people tend to be very imaginative, but it's also because he was an interesting figure. Except for Moses, Abraham is really the most elaborately drawn portrait in the Pentateuch, and in some sense within the whole Old Testament. His life and experiences are a fertile ground for the imagination, and many biblical commentators, as we know, lacking other gifts, have employed this one to the full. Consider only some of the things that he did. He traveled all over the ancient Near East, from Arabia, Mesopotamia, Egypt. He lived for a spell in ancient Sodom. He married a beautiful woman who was desired by a king and a pharaoh. He was a warrior who defends his nephew Lot. He has a child by a slave girl. He experienced a vision of God. He received the unique promise that his seed would be blessed and numbered as the stars. He makes a covenant with God, sealed with circumcision. He and his wife have a son when they're 100 years old. And when this son is a young boy, God asks him to offer him as a sacrifice. And the stories go on and on and on. And lest we forget, these are all the experiences of a semi-nomad, a Bedouin, who roams through the Middle East much as these Bedouins do today. So there's just a kind of a tantalizing character to Abraham and a richness to his person. So it is not surprising then that Abraham has become almost a primal symbol for Jews, for Christians, and more important, for the Muslims. Abraham is the central figure for the Muslims. And it would be very interesting, I think, to have a section on the Muslim interpretation, very much stressing the monotheism. It's perhaps even richer. Now, Abraham, for this reason, cannot be comprehended in one idea, or one motif, or one theme. He's much too interesting and much too elusive for that. In ancient Israel, he was remembered as the founder of the race, and it was thought to stand at the beginning of the saving events which lead up to the Exodus. So the passage that Krenz quoted in Isaiah, "Look to the rock from which you were hewn, to the quarry from which you were dug. Look to your father Abraham and Sarah who gave your birth." But even within Judaism, as we've seen, Abraham came to mean different things. Faithful man, a man who stood up under trials, a man who was a model of sacrificial giving, a man who represented monotheistic belief. As Israel had new experiences and found itself in new historical and cultural situations, it created new views of Abraham. It is as though every time people take a fresh look at Abraham, they discover something new about him. And I think this is the case with the New Testament as well. For with the new revelation that comes to men in Christ, men discovered aspects of Abraham that they had not seen before. So both Paul and John and the other writers give Abraham's faith a new point of reference by directing it at Christ, and thereby give his trust in God a new significance. Now our concern, of course, is the period after this. The period after the New Testament, which is primarily these 400 or 500 years, is not unique in respect to its creative contributions, for it stands in a new relation to Abraham, which is different from those who have preceded. The writers of the first 4 or 5 centuries stand after the New Testament, so they assume that as part of the tradition. And they also stand after the Jewish interpretation which George presented to us. They also have the prophets. And they have, of course, the book of Genesis itself. And they have Philo and Josephus and all of these other writers. So they stand, at least in their time, at the end of a developing tradition. We, of course, stand further along in the development of this tradition, and we have their work to build on itself. What this suggests, I think, is that the proper question for us to ask is not how well do the fathers interpret the account in Genesis, or how well do they interpret the historical Abraham, or how faithfully do they stick to the text without allegorizing or moralizing or reading in ideas that have no place there. Nor should we ask how faithfully do they hand on the New Testament interpretation or interpretations. But how do they, in their new situation, with the rich tradition of Abraham at their disposal, appropriate this tradition of which they are the next stage? That is, what do they make of this tradition in their new setting? Obviously, I'm working with a little different sense, I think, probably of history here. I would not be so inclined to distinguish history from interpretation or history from faith as was suggested yesterday. It seems to me the historian is wound up with interpreting both what happened and what it meant to those people who experienced it, either in their time or after. So when I talk about a historical interpretation, I'm talking about the interaction between events and those things which people think about the events, and both are part of the historical understanding. I've already illustrated some of the variety of views, but let me mention several others. First of all, even the artistic representations are not unified. Though the sacrifice of Isaac is the most frequent, the scene at Mamre is often pictured, with Abraham solicitously entertaining his guests and shuttling back and forth between the tent where Sarah cooks and the table where his guests sit. In the liturgy, I found this very interesting. Abraham is mentioned in several anaphoras, that is, in the Eucharistic prayer, because the offering of Isaac was taken as a type of the Eucharistic offering. He is mentioned in a mass for the barrenness of women because of his faith that Sarah would bear a child. He is mentioned in connection with the blessing of a marriage, and he is recalled because of his faithfulness and obedience in other liturgical prayers. So even if you move out of the kind of material that we've already talked about, you find that it simply keeps growing in terms of variety. Abraham realized, and this of course is one of the Augustinian interpretations, that one must obey the divine command no matter what the consequences. When the divine commandment thunders, it has to be obeyed, not disputed. So he picks up that particular motif. However, it is not simply enough to note the variety of interpretation. However, that is surely instructive to ponder just the sheer fertility of the Christian imagination in only this one small matter. The more important consideration is how Greek and Roman writers, who were not Jews and who were urban men living in the great cities of the Roman Empire, made this ancient Semitic Bedouin a credible and a compelling witness to the Christian faith. And to do this, we must place their comments within their historical context. And what I would like to do is to take two contexts in which early Christianity developed and to illustrate how they did this. The one is the context of Hellenistic culture and the Greco-Roman world, and the other is in its dialogue or polemic against Judaism. And it's my conviction that it's within these two settings that early Christianity takes its form, and you can understand why things happen and how they happen if one places it into that context. But we must remember that it was not Christians alone who read the book of Genesis. Jews read this same book after the beginning of Christianity as well, and they too revered Abraham. And many pagans knew the Septuagint, that is, the Greek translation of the Hebrew scriptures. Those who read it, other than Christians, knew that Christians, their claims to the contrary, often practiced an exotic form of exegesis to discover support for their beliefs within a Jewish book. And even when they did not play off the kind of interpretation the Christians gave against the Jewish, they were appalled by the crudity of the imagery to be found in the Jewish scriptures, the lurid accounts of Yahweh's dealings with men, In short, the excessive anthropomorphizing of the deity. Partly why allegory develops. Allegory in the early church is a rational attempt to overcome the obstacles that the Bible sets in the way of understanding God's relationship to man. What could be more barbaric than the deity compelling a father to sacrifice his son? Finally, within the churches themselves, that is, not only in relationship to Greco-Roman culture or to Judaism, bishops, priests, catechists were seeking to forge acceptable models of conduct and teaching and faith from the Bible for teaching the young and for instructing the faithful. So that in a tradition that was relatively unformed, where you didn't have Concordia Publishing House to send you materials to use for your class, and it wasn't only that you didn't have somebody to publish the material, but you didn't know exactly what it was that you were to say, because that yet had not been determined, one had to find models which would be credible and compelling to pass on an acceptable understanding of the faith. And it is in this light, I think, not in terms of whether they rightly understand the earlier forms of the tradition, that we should view the early Christian interpretations of Abraham. And to do this, I should like to take but two views and show how they came to assume the features that they did. The first is the Christological. For the beginning of Christianity, the Jewish scriptures, and I'll probably be using that term rather than Old Testament, were cited in support of Christian claims. But the Hebrew Bible or the Jewish scriptures or the Septuagint were still Jewish books. Jews knew that, Christians knew that, and the pagans knew that. And Jews continued to appeal for them, as did the Christians. And even some Christians themselves had doubts about whether they should be using a Jewish Bible. The most famous person there, of course, is Marcion. They thought Christianity would compromise itself if it allowed Christians to continually cite Jewish books in support of their beliefs. For many Christians, then, it was essential to show that the events in the Jewish Bible and the great figures of Jewish history and legend could be interpreted in a Christian way. The most obvious way to do this was to stress the Christological character of the Jewish Bible. That is, it is not sufficient, or so they thought, simply to show broad lines of continuity between Israel and Christianity. That is, for example, by stressing monotheism. The only credible link between Israel and Christianity was thought to be Christ. And this meant showing the Christological sense behind every major event and personages in Israel's history, whether it be the Exodus, the exile, David, the sacrifices of the temple, circumcision, or whatever. The meaning of Israel's history was to be found in Christ. And if this were so, Abraham could not simply be a figure who looked forward to the fulfillment of God's promise for the Jews. He had to be part of the history of salvation leading to Christ and a believer in Christ. So Irenaeus, a pastor in Gaul in the second century, says, "The faith of Abraham and the faith of the apostles in our faith is one and the same." The other person that we mentioned earlier, Melito, who was a bishop in Sardis, illustrates, I think, the peculiar situation of Christians in the second and third centuries. This man, Melito, lived in Sardis, a Greek city in Asia Minor, where he was bishop roughly 160 to 180 AD, of what must have been a very small Christian community, probably just a few hundred people. The Christians there lived in the shadow of a well-established, large, flourishing Jewish community, which had been in Sardis for several hundred years. And the Christians were newcomers, 20, 30, 40 years, that long. These Jews had achieved such importance in Sardis that some served on the city council, and the Jews were wealthy enough and influential enough to have built an enormous synagogue on the main street of the city. The synagogue was some 300 feet in length. So every time the Christians went out to shop, they walked by the synagogue. And when it came time for the Sabbath, everyone was going into the synagogue. And when it came time for the Jewish holidays, they noticed that the Jews were very active religiously. If you've lived in a Jewish neighborhood, you get some impression, especially in September and October, when they come, as Chrysostom says, continuously in one after another, the holidays. Now, Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, and then Sukkah, and they all come within about 30 days, and you're very much aware of the Jewish activity. So this was on the main street, some 300 feet in length, prominent place, surrounded by shops and other buildings. This was an irritant, to put it mildly, to the Christians there who claimed to be the inheritors of this Jewish tradition. And from Melito's other writings, we know that he had an excessive hostility to the Jews. And it is not conjecture to think that his feelings were prompted in part by the situation of the Christian community in relationship to this much more impressive Jewish community. So the Christian claims about the Jewish scriptures would have sounded weak and feeble in such a setting, if not presumptuous. Now consider further that in another synagogue, and I always come here to St. Louis and I meet Ed Krentz and I mention something to him. He says, well, have you heard about that? And then he'll go to the library and pull out a volume, and of course I haven't heard about that. So the one good instance I had, I now have two as of meeting Ed Krentz the other day. But in any case, I'll show you mine since I'm a little sure about it. But his certainly is equally important. This is a synagogue that was discovered and excavated in the last 30 years over Mesopotamia. Now, it's not in Sardis, and it's about 100 years later. And for that reason, I don't want to draw any direct parallels with Melito. But on the Torah shrine, we find three things. We find the menorah, a representation of the temple, and the sacrifice of Isaac. Now, on the basis of what George Nicholsberg said and some of the things that I've done myself, it's obvious that the sacrifice of Isaac was an important figure or important motif within the Judaism of the time. And it became even more important after the destruction of the temple and the loss of the city and then the wars with the Romans, because the Jews were in much more difficult circumstances. And so they needed models which would show how a Jew at an earlier period had stood fast when everything looked bleak and God's promises did not seem to be coming true. So Isaac and Abraham become very significant. Now, if we consider this and its importance, and then we go back to Melito, we notice that it is very interesting that he makes of the sacrifice of Isaac such an important Christian symbol. It is for this reason that he takes it Christologically and not in terms of Abraham's faith. The true meaning, he is saying to his Jewish neighbors, is not to be found in steadfastness or obedience or faith or hope, but in Christ. For the sacrifice prefigures Christ's suffering and his death on the cross for all men. Thus, he then takes each detail as if to say, if you look carefully at what happened with Isaac, you will say that it's saying the same thing. He was bound, he was led to the cross, he was silent, he bore the wood as Christ bore the cross, the ram was caught in the bush as Christ hung on the cross. And he then, he says, becomes a type to us of the new mystery. And we now contemplate a son led by his father to the hill to be sacrificed, a father who, binding his son, placed him upon the sacrificial firewood while hastily making ready all that was needed. Isaac remained silent, not opening his mouth nor uttering a sound. The difference between Isaac and Jesus is that Isaac did not suffer finally. He did not die, but Jesus did. So what I'm saying is that the Christological interpretation comes to prominence because it was necessary to appropriate this for Christian use in a Jewish setting. A somewhat different context, this is very briefly, but it illustrates another kind of interpretation which is somewhat similar. In a somewhat different context, Christians were concerned about the use of the Old Testament. Some Christians, such as Marcion, a second century man, said we should not have anything to do with the Old Testament, and some Gnostics said the same thing. So they tried to take the Old Testament and to show why it had to be understood for them as Christians. So this is more kind of inner Christian problem. Marcion, according to Irenaeus, said, Marcion, Irenaeus says, excluded Abraham from the inheritance, even though Paul said he believed in God, and this was counted as righteousness. Both these Gnostics and Marcions, according to Irenaeus, believed that Yahweh was an inferior God, who was much inferior to the high God whom they worship. But Irenaeus says that's not true. He says we possess the same faith as Abraham. We worship the same God. For Abraham, according to his faith, followed the command of the word of God, and with a ready mind delivered up as a sacrifice to God his only and beloved son, in order that God might be pleased to offer up for all his seed his only beloved son for our redemption. There is only one God, and his covenant with Israel is part of the covenant with all men. So the dispensation in Christ is a continuation. And if Abraham is excluded from this history, God is divided into two. And that we cannot tolerate. So in this sense, the phrase, the God of Abraham, takes on renewed significance. So these two interpretations, both Christological, though of a somewhat different sort, illustrate how the figure of Abraham came to have meaning for a new generation of people, Christians, and how they used Abraham to show that the Jewish tradition and the Jewish scriptures were as much theirs as that of the Jews. And it was the one God who revealed himself then and now. Thus the story with such obvious possibilities of interpretation becomes then a type of the sacrifice on the cross. All right, should I stop here for a while? I have about... Do you want a break here, or do you want me to just finish it up? What time is it?
You have 25 minutes. Dinner is at 12:15 today, so we can run until 5 or 10 after, if you like.
Yes, sir.
Robert, would there be any life situation or predicament that would move one of these communities to seize upon Abraham as a type? Or would they be led to seize upon Abraham through their involvement with the scriptures?
I think it's really a combination of both. I mean, as I mentioned later on here, they don't go to material outside of the scriptures because of their own religious background. So they knew this material, and it came to them passing on meanings about Abraham. But the new situation requires that be given a new meaning. And I think that in this particular case, it's a combination of a reinterpreted tradition and the need to speak to a specific, very concrete context. And maybe I appear hung up on the whole Jewishness, but it's really a remarkably different mindset when one is a minority, which obviously we're not here, among Jews, or at least a small, struggling Christian community alongside a well-established Jewish community. So you meet your neighbor and says, you know, where do you come off with that kind of stuff? So it's a very concrete type thing. Yes, sir,
I appreciate this presentation very much. Not only I appreciate the content of the paper, but the type of historical, theological philosophy that is behind the paper. Now the question what I want to raise is, there are some indigenous Indian theologians saying that if the meanings of the life of Abraham or other figures in the Old Testament to be meaningful to the Indian context, as your paper so suggests, Abraham had to change in different times and situations. Now, to make the life of the Old Testament figures meaningful to Indian culture and historical situation now, it is better to get away from the Old Testament and return to Bhagavad Gita, or better. Now, I'd like to hear some of your comments. How religious theology develop?
Could we hold that till this afternoon? We, Joe, will have this time after lunch where there won't be any presentation to speak of, and maybe we could get into it there.
Okay.
John?
Father, did you notice as you were going through some of those fathers, particularly, let's say, in the sermons or catechetical material, did they tend to light on different themes or sections of the Testaments depending on the geographic and social cultural situation of the audience? But I mean, suppose the Christian community was in the midst of a pagan situation where Jews...
That's what I'm going to come to next. That's the other model I'm going to put forward.
Okay, good.
I don't want to talk to you later about this to see whether, to what extent we need to do to differ on this thing. From what you said, I don't really see any basic distinction. I may not have made it clear, I would not want to indicate that the faith of Abraham, Israel, Melito is not a proper historical object of historical study. It must be. The faith that I had in history that I was trying to distinguish between is the historiographer's faith, Robert Wilkins' faith, from his historiography, to recognize there's a distinction there.
That's part of the problem, Carl. I think that as a working historian, I would assume that my own, let's not say my faith, my own subjective experience and historical circumstances are part of what it means for me to be a historian. That's kind of the working way most historians today in this country think of themselves, in contrast to the 19th century. That's sometimes have, but we are different, so we see it different. So the history is not concerned with simply what happened, but how it is subjectively appropriated. Now, that doesn't mean it's fantasy or poetry or something of that sort. There has to be a scientific base on which people agree. But what actually is produced finally is, and that must make history interesting, the subjective element.
I guess in my own model, I would push that into the more into the assumptions with which I work, and let consciously try to make some divisions as I'm in the process of doing this, making it just.
So the assumptions are everything that one does. You know, what he considers to be sources, what kind of materials he is drawn to, how he selects. You know, whenever you sit down to write an article or a book, you realize that how much you are selecting certain materials to include and leaving out others. Now, that's not purely. Especially when you've got, it's a little different when you've only got so much material that you've got to cover everything that's there, as you do sometimes in the cases you're talking about. But as one moves into periods where you have more material than you can possibly use, and then even where you have limited material, it depends on what context you're going to place that material in. And the context is something that's very much determined by other factors.
Bob, you've kind of been talking, and it seems to me that, let's say, people who are surrounded by Jews or who somehow realize they've got a relationship to these Jewish scriptures, illustrating the Christian faith by their own interpretations of these materials. Is there a tension with, say, what we might call, for want of a better term, classical Christianity or Nicene Christianity, in a sense, got its source, or its the reason why it came out as it did was because of, in a sense, it's rather peculiar interpretation of things like Abraham. That is, it's not like taking the atonement and finding it there in a nice little story in Abraham and Isaac, but that model actually could be the thing that would form images of, say, something like the atonement.
Yeah, I think that's a very helpful way of putting it, that, you know, sometimes we say because a person in doing his interpretation of the Bible seems to be somewhat arbitrary in the choice of material, in the way he puts certain texts together, as Prince was pointing out to us this morning. The fact is that he is choosing those texts from the Bible. The two texts come from the Bible rather than, let us say, from Homer. And that can't be overemphasized. It's because of the nature of the material that he's working with that conditions what he is doing. So what appears to be very arbitrary, looking at it from one perspective, really is within a tradition that has some pretty fixed parameters to it. So I think the relationship is very, I would say, dialectical. It's going back and forth. One is, as I say later on, one is shaping that which he has received, and that which one has received is shaping him.
That's what
yeah, I was thinking, let's say, in terms of something like the death of Jesus, obviously the way that event is understood changes as it's seen with different pairs of glasses, whether one is in a Hellenistic environment or reading it as a Jew or whatever.
So you want to assess the context of the milieu culturally.
And the effect that really had on the Christian message, where I think your presentation has really been largely in terms of them justifying why we still appeal these two scriptures. I just want to see how they bounce in this other direction.
When I first heard you say that, I thought you were saying kind of what is the basic problem that historians have in this period, namely that which Otto von Harnack laid on all of us about the Hellenization of the gospel, that somehow it was because the gospel became part of the Greco-Roman milieu that all sorts of false things were introduced. Now that's the way in which many people have viewed it. Seems to me there's another way of viewing it, at least two ways when I present it. One is to pick up the Jewish context and say that continues on into the early church. It is not just part of primitive Christianity. The second is to say that, in fact, if you look at what is called Hellenizing, you're seeing that so much of what has been handed on in the biblical tradition is shaping and criticizing and evaluating the cultural material that it's not possible to identify with that. In other words, what Origen writes is not what Philo or what Numenius or somebody of that sort or Plutarch would write, because he's spending all his time worrying about Jesus and Abraham and the Bible and these kind of things. So I think that, you know, that I think that puts it, I think, in the wrong terms. The same thing goes for, you know, every generation. It's back and forth. And what comes out then is the result. Now, some people tend to be more sort of within the internal life of the tradition, and some more on the edge. I think that's a common experience that all of us have. That's just something that they had then. Probably will find themselves much more sympathetic to American culture. And say, well, you know, reason why, you know, we can't see certain things in terms of the Christian tradition. I would say, no, you know, we've got to stand off a little bit more. I'm sure if we would take hands in this room, we'd find quite different attitudes than anybody who's got to teach or interpret. Ed?
At the outset, you several times, several ways, said you did not see your task to find out who was right, or at least more than you were right, in the interpretation of the Isaac Abraham tradition. But that your job was to try to report, show how, in the second, third, fourth, and fifth situations, they used the Abraham Isaac tradition for their situation. In Sardis, insofar as your reconstruction went, do you think Melito and, let's say, the chief rabbi of that football league synagogue ever met on the street and merely engaged in that kind of conversation, and the rabbi said, well, I can see how you apply that to your minority situation here. And Melito said, well, I can see how you guys apply that to your majority situation here. But they never got out and said, wait a minute, you are at least less than accurate in how you read Genesis. And if so, on what grounds did they try to argue that out? The grounds for having a right interpretation and not just an appropriately applicable one.
Well, they, of course, would not use the term appropriately applicable. What I'm saying is that the two views would be represented in two different traditions of interpretation, would go in different ways. But as they themselves experienced it, they, I think, somewhat unfortunately took one excluding the other. So that you had to win all of that. And if you read the book by Justin against Trifold, you know, after he said what he wants to say, that they don't understand their own scriptures, then he just keeps pulling out one psalm after another. He says, look, how stupid can you be? Don't you see what that means? It's how blind, how foolish. He just brings out one text after another. So there's a sense of, and the Jews did the same thing. So, I mean, the two become exclusive of each other. And they believe that they had a common basis for deciding, but...
Well, I guess I'm pushing it, my thing. Could a historian seek to push? Now, maybe you're saying, I do push to see what the sufficient grounds are that each one of these men thinks he has of your tradition. And I find that either there is nothing, or that they've both got the same expressed sufficient grounds, that they come out with different answers. But I see that to be the tradition, for example, in the John 8 text, which Ed didn't get to this morning, that Jesus and the Jews are fighting, arguing on what does it really mean to be an Abrahamite. And it's finally, one of us is right, the other one is wrong. That is the upshot of that argument.
Well, that, of course, is the perennial problem, and one can't, I'm sure, say in a matter of this sort that there are certain views which seem somewhat preposterous or at least fanciful, and there are others which are more in line with the shape that the tradition has taken. And it would seem to me that, you know, one could say that the stress on Abraham as faithful, as trusting, as obedient, would be more to the center of the tradition than interpretation would see in terms of the values of women. Now, I think there's a clear way in which you can say this is right and that's wrong. On the other hand, the interpretation that I just presented, the cryptological interpretation, presupposes certain judgments which are made about Jesus. And so if one is going to make those judgments, then he has to give this kind of interpretation as perhaps foreign as it may appear to us, if we don't tend to do things that way. He has to give it more credence than I think he would normally, because this is the way Christians who had assumed what Ed was talking about went on to the next stage. Now, a later stage that may be forgotten, probably has been forgotten. But it seems to me the important question that I didn't know which way you were heading on that, is not simply the historical question, but it's our question, you see, which we should talk about is that, and where do we go once we have some awareness of where the tradition has been? I would say that the answer to that question is as much everybody in the room is capable of going at that one as I am. And probably many are more capable because they have more sensitivities to where maybe more Christian people are than I might, being kind of dug in here. But, yeah.
You wanted a viewpoint of Torah and circumcision and Sabbath that would somewhat reflect the viewpoint of Judaism. And if we come back to our theme, Abraham, the father of us all, that wouldn't include only Judaism. That would certainly include Islam. And maybe we should have had a resource person like Muhammad Ali or Karim Jabbar or Mark Tenenbaum to sit in with us and play some of these scenes back from behind the scenes, which is very difficult for us to see because we're all Christians.
I think that would be a very useful way to go at it. We've not gone into that way, so you know, we should proceed, I think. But that, I would find it to be very helpful. I wanted to ask another question. Oh, I'm sorry.
I'm not sure if I caught. Let me say it for that.
All right. I was going to, before I go on and next, this has nothing to do with it, but I wanted to read it at some time. This is another Jewish interpretation, which I found to be very beautiful. This is a midrash on Genesis. Until Abraham's time, the Lord was known only as the Lord of heaven. When he appeared to Abraham, he became the God of the earth as well as of the heaven, for he brought him nigh to man.
Very beautiful.
All right, the other is Abraham is a model for Christian life. Men need models, and if they don't have them, they'll create them. Whether these models come from the immediate past, John Kennedy, Martin Luther King, or whether during their lifetime they achieve some kind of almost mythical status, Malcolm X, John Wayne, Charles de Gaulle, or whether they are taken from the far distant past. As each new generation comes along, they rejuvenate and retouch these ancient models in light of their unique hopes and dreams.
What a community or a society prizes most highly is not expressed simply in its values or its beliefs. It is also embodied in historical and mythical personages. So one can, for example, write a history of American values by noting the changing attitudes toward George Washington or Thomas Jefferson or Abraham Lincoln, the way that image changes as time passes. And the same could be done for religious traditions. So probably some of you have studied this in the case of Martin Luther. At one time, he's the reformer who stands firm against the papacy. At another time, the teacher and the theologian. At another time, the national symbol and embodiment of German character. At another time, the existentialist thinker and believer. And even Jesus himself has been at times an ascetic, a monk, a social reformer, the teacher of brotherhood and fatherhood of God, a martyr, the victor, and today, of course, the darling of the Jesus people. Now, the early Christian communities needed models as well, but they were reluctant to seek them in the poems of Homer or the myths and the legends handed on in their popular culture. There were figures there who could be put to Christian use. Socrates standing firm for truth against the city officials in Athens, or Diogenes giving up all his goods, or Brutus sending his son to death. But the Christians went instead to the Jewish scriptures, in part because Christian tradition was not well enough known or ancient enough to have created figures of universal and historical proportions, and in part because Christians considered the Jewish tradition their own. To many Christians, then, Abraham came to represent the epitome of trust in God's promise and obedience to God's command, no matter what the circumstances men found themselves in or how high the conditions. Now, to men who lived within the cultural milieu and the moral consciousness of the Greco-Roman world, for Abraham to become a model of trust and obedience and faith, he became a model which then conformed to prevailing assumptions and expectations of what it meant to be a good man. And he was a superb symbol because he represented the conflict between one's natural feelings and inclinations as a father and a human being, and devotion to a higher good, namely to God. Abraham had to choose between his paternal feelings toward his son and his devotion to God, the one natural bond created by the flesh on the one hand, and the other a spiritual bond created by God. So the love of God was contrasted with the love of the flesh. Now, one could call this a moral interpretation. I think I would not be have the same kind of connotation in moral that Nicholsburg did. Moral is a pretty good term in my language, I suppose. And moralizing is simply an unfortunate way to talk about moral concerns. So the details then of the sacrifice of Isaac take on extraordinary significance when placed into this context, for they're treated with high sensitivity to the personal and the psychological experience of Abraham, almost in the fashion that Kierkegaard does in his classic work in the 19th century. So Origen, in his sermon, and these are sermons, says, "It's interesting that Yahweh said, 'Take your son,' and then he says, 'Your very dear son, the one you love.'" He wasn't satisfied to just say, "Take your son." It did not suffice to say, "son," but he said, "dear son, the one you love." This was done to give greater proof that Abraham was truly obedient, greater proof to men. That is, to make the test more severe. By the expression of tenderness and affection, repeated over and over in the account, Yahweh roused in Abraham his paternal sentiments in order that the father, by remembering his love for the boy, would be driven to hesitate to sacrifice and to allow the whole army of the flesh to stand in revolt against the faith and the spirit. Now, somewhat in the same tradition, Gregory of Nyssa, writing in the 4th century, goes into great detail as Abraham ascends the mountain. He says, why did it take him 3 days to get to the top of the mountain? This was to give Abraham 3 days in which he had to travel and live with his son. He had to eat with him. He had to talk with him. He said when he slept with him at night, the boy would cuddle up next to him because he was warm in the tent. It's really just the sensitivity. And that during the time, Abraham would have to contemplate. In fact, he would be tormented by the thought of what was to come. So the 3 days was to heighten the test. He was allowed time to confront in the course of the journey the paternal feelings and his faith, the love of God and the love of the flesh, the attraction of the things of the present and the expectation of the things to come. And then Origen turns to his congregation. He says, directly, fathers in the congregation, I want you to listen. If we consider Abraham's love of God and his love for his son, we should realize that those of you who have lost a son in the ordinary course of life and who grieve over this loss can learn much from Abraham. For the biblical account of his firmness and strength of soul bids us recognize how paltry our own faith and devotion. You have lost children through natural causes, and you act as though this loss was greater than the loss of God. But Abraham was asked to choose between God and his son and to demonstrate his faith by his own hand. And he gave generously of his son. If you wish to be the children of Abraham, do Abraham's works. Show your faith in God to be stronger than your human feelings. For Abraham, though he loved his son, preferred the love of God than human love. Now, there are some similarities here between the flesh and the spirit in Paul, but there are also important differences. For one, the tension between flesh and spirit is not, as far as I can see, projected onto Abraham by Paul. Abraham plays a different role, as we saw. More importantly, Origen, Gregory, Ambrose, and others who use this are really being influenced, but Christianizing a kind of stoic moral. And this meant that the ethical and religious goal was to be free from the drives and desires and the passions of the flesh, these human needs, and to be free of this and to reach the love of God. Or to put it another way, one strives to live in harmony with the true reason, the world soul, and not to be subject to the fleeting, arbitrary, momentary moods and inclinations and distractions of the present. So Abraham became cast in this mold, but given a much richer, I think, religious orientation. Yet it is striking, as I say, how different than the language is used by Origen and others of Abraham and the language used by Seneca, Epictetus, and Musonius Rufus, ethical writers in the period, when talking about the ideal man. For the key element in the view of the Christian writers is not devotion to reason, but to God. And the temptation he faces causes him to choose between the love of God and the human love. So ethical here is really equivalent to praxis in relationship to God. So Abraham is not wholly a Greek. This maybe answers your question. He retains the contours of the biblical tradition as well. What is, however, most significant about the portrait is that it is primarily ethical and moral in the sense that I've defined it. The reason for this is obvious. As Christianity was making its way in the Greco-Roman world, especially in the 2nd century and 3rd century, this view of Abraham was being formed because Christianity was impressing people by its moral fervor and zeal. So Abraham could be cited by Christians as an example of the kind of man true faith would produce, both by preachers addressing their congregation, to people who had little sense of what this tradition was about, were new to it, and by missionaries who sought to bring new men and women into the church. So faith in Christ made it possible for a man to forego the desires and inclinations of the flesh, to turn to a true service and devotion to God. Now, conclusion here. I'm missing a page. I have a conclusion, but I seem to be missing one page of it. I'd rather find it before I get into it. Excuse me. I was writing on it. That's probably the reason why. I'm going to stop now. All righty. That would be possible. That's a good idea. All right.